Hello and welcome back to the Alnwick Castle podcast. I'm Daniel Watkins.
And I'm Deborah Beecroft.
And today's episode is all about the life of Bill Richmond.
You might have read about Richmond in Greg Jenner's book Dead Famous or watched the character inspired by him on Bridgerton. Today we're speaking to Luke Williams, author of Richmond Unchanged, the biography of the world's first black sporting superstar.
Born into slavery in America, young Bill was liberated through the intervention of Earl Percy, the future second Duke of Northumberland and Lord of Alnwick Castle. Bill travelled to England with the Duke as a free man, becoming a cabinet maker and then a boxer. His fame grew, and in 1821 he had an official role at the coronation of King George IV.
We spoke to Luke about all these things and more, including just how different it was to be a boxer 200 years ago.
You might hear a difference in sound quality in the main part of the interview. We did have a few microphone issues, but hopefully you'll still be able to hear everything clearly.
Please enjoy.
We're very happy to be joined on today's episode of the Alnwick Castle podcast by Luke G. Williams, the author of Richmond Unchanged. Thank you for joining us today, Luke. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Thanks very much for the opportunity to come on and talk about Bill Richmond.
Well, I think we probably need to start with a question about you.
And I suppose that would be, how did you first hear about Bill Richmond?
Yeah, so I've always been a big boxing fan, not so much the modern day sport, but the history of the sport I've always found very fascinating. There's a lot of intersections between boxing, social and cultural history. It was pretty much the first sport that existed on an organised scale in Britain, you know, back in the sort of 1700s, 1800s, along with horse racing. It was the major sport. And it offered an opportunity for people from, at that time, disadvantaged backgrounds, whether they might be Jewish or black, to sort of advance within society. So we've got a series of quite fascinating figures in the history of boxing who have quite a historical significance behind them. And Bill Richmond himself was the first black boxer to achieve any level of celebrity, and he achieved a high level of celebrity. And when I first found out about him, it was through reading a novel called Black Ajax by George MacDonald Fraser, who wrote the Flashman novels. And I'd never heard of Bill Richmond, despite my interest in boxing history. I didn't know that much about the Bare Knuckle era, but I knew a bit, but I'd never seen his name before. And I got digging, finding out about him, and seeing such a fascinating character. And I was astonished that nobody had written a book about him. Around about the same time, there was a documentary on Channel 4, so I think this was around 2004, about Bill. And I watched that. It was a fantastic documentary. I remember going to the library trying to find a book about him. There was nothing there. He only got sort of passing mentions in sort of the history of boxing literature. So I thought, you know, he seemed like such a key figure, such an interesting figure. I thought, well, I'll find out more. I'll do some research. So I researched it probably for about 10 years. And the whole way I was researching it, I had in the back of my head, I'd turn it into a book one day. But I also thought someone else might get there first, because I thought, surely someone's going to write a book about him one day. Nobody did. So in the end, I did it myself.
So it was the first biography of him, really?
Yeah, absolutely. There'd been a good essay in BBC History magazine by a historian called Greg Jenner, who also done a lot of research into Bill Richmond. And there were articles here and there, but no full-length biography at all, which I thought was a real oversight in sporting history, really. I mean, when we think about the history of sort of black sport and black boxers, we think about Muhammad Ali, we think about Jack Johnson, who were sort of 20th century pioneers, but Bill Richmond, who was there 100 years earlier, there was nothing proper about him, and I thought that oversight needed to be corrected.
So you mentioned that you had an interest in the history of boxing as it was. Can you tell us a little bit about what boxing was like in the early 19th century and how it differs to how it is today?
When we think about boxing back in those days, we have to sort of eliminate most thoughts in modern day boxing. So to start with, there were no gloves. So the sport was probably fought at a slower pace, but it was much more violent and potentially gory and bloody than it is today. You know, to modern sensibilities, it seems quite savage, actually, the way that boxing was back then. And another big difference in terms of the rules was, you know, today a boxing match will last for 12 3-minute rounds. There's a 1-minute gap every 3 minutes, but in the bare knuckle days it was a fight to the finish. So a round only ended when somebody was knocked down. Then you had a 30-second gap where you had to get back to the line in the middle called scratch, which is where the expression come up to scratch originates from. And as long as you got back to scratch, the fight continued. So there were accounts of fights that would last hours, 60, 70, 80 rounds sometimes fights would go on. So the rules are very different. In terms of the sort of hoopla surrounding the sport, though, there's quite a lot of similarities with today. I don't know if people have been following, you know, the Tyson Fury and Alexander Usyk. They're trying to negotiate a big heavyweight fight at the moment. And there's back and forth about money and location and who's going to get the bigger share of the purse and all of that. That's pretty much identical to how it was in the bare knuckle days as well, because the sport itself was inexorably linked with money and with gambling. It was known as prize fighting for a reason. So there would be debates about how much the purse was going to be. There would be debates about where the fights were going to be held. Boxing itself was probably, the legal experts sort of disagree on this, but it was essentially probably illegal in certain parts of the country. Magistrates would try and shut down fights, so that you would often have fights. You know, it was quite a renegade activity taking place on the boundaries of different counties, so they could evade the magistrates who'd try and close them down. But at the same time, although it was a renegade activity, the biggest fighters were incredibly famous in Britain at that time. They were the leading sports stars, you know, the sort of the David Beckhams, the Lionel Messis of the day. Their exploits were covered in the newspapers. Their lives were covered in detail in the papers of the times. Most newspapers in that era, probably about 4 pages, a typical newspaper, and sometimes the accounts of fights would fill up half a page of those 4 pages with the detailed accounts of it. So boxing, which today has become a bit of a niche sport, in those days it was the leading sport, and the boxers themselves, the leading celebrities of the day. A lot of those people, like Bill Richmond, have now been a little bit forgotten about in the modern era, but they were the first sports stars in Britain, effectively.
The subtitle of the book calls Richmond the world's first black sporting superstar. So he really was a superstar. He was incredibly famous at the time.
Yeah, he was. I mean, he was renowned not only as a boxer, but as a great trainer and a promoter as well. And sort of a measure of his fame and the fame that boxers at that time enjoyed is around when King George, at his coronation, Bill Richmond was there along with another group of boxers to sort of act as ushers and bodyguards and add a bit of sort of celebrity stardust to the coronation. And I think that's a sort of graphic illustration of how famous Bill was and how famous, you know, boxers or pugilists, as they were called, were at that time.
He was a boxer, but he didn't start out as a boxer. So can you tell us a little bit about his early life before he arrived in Britain?
Yeah, so Bill was born on the 5th of August 1763, by all accounts, in Staten Island, just off New York in America. So he was born into slavery. He was a house slave for an Anglican vicar called the Reverend Richard Charlton. And, you know, to be honest, you know, being born as a house slave in America, but being born into slavery at that time, you know, the prospects were not good. But Bill's life was transformed at the age of 13. So for his first 13 years, he was in Staten Island, you know, working as a slave, pretty unrelenting, horrible existence. But in 1776, the British arrive in Staten Island. It was in the midst of the War of Independence. And this is where the connection with Alnwick comes about. General Hugh Percy, the second Duke of Northumberland later, arrives in Staten Island, serving for the British. And we don't exactly know how he and Bill first met each other, but Percy transforms Bill's life because he, a year later, takes Bill back to England. Bill is no longer a slave and gives Bill a real opportunity to make something of his life.
Can you tell us a little bit about what happened with Bill and Percy? Because by the time he goes over to England, he has been freed. Do we know whether Percy had anything to do with being able to liberate Bill?
Yeah, to be honest with you, we don't know the full facts behind the story. There's a lot of different theories and different conjectures, so I can quickly run through the different possibilities. All that we do know is that Percy was clearly instrumental in freeing Bill somehow. How exactly he did it, we don't know. There are some accounts that claim Percy saw the 13-year-old Bill sort of having a bit of a rumble with a few British soldiers outside a tavern and was sort of impressed by his athleticism and his prowess and sort of took an interest in him after that, which led to him taking Bill on as part of his staff and persuading the Reverend Richard Charlton, who was Bill's slave owner, to let him take Bill back to England. So that's one theory. Another theory is that Percy was dining with the Reverend Charlton's residence in Staten Island, and Bill announced a toast to King George, demonstrating his loyalty to the crown, and sort of, again, charmed Percy with his sort of outgoing personality and charisma. And that's why Percy wanted him as part of his staff and took him back to England. A third theory, which I advance in my book, is that there was possibly some sort of family connection between Bill and the Reverend Charlton, that possibly Bill was a secret son of the Reverend Charlton or of one of his offspring, and that in person, Reverend Charlton saw an opportunity to free Bill, who was related to him, and sort of persuaded Percy to take Bill with him back to England. So we don't know the real answer to the story. It is one of those great mysteries of Bill's life, but what we do know is that Bill left with Percy in May 1777 and came back to England with him. We also know that Percy himself was a supporter of abolitionist causes. He was a subscriber to different abolition texts later on, so clearly slavery was an institution that he disapproved of. So it's pretty clear, I think, that his motives for helping Bill and bringing Bill back to England were humanitarian ones.
And once they were back in England, that wasn't the end of it. They did stay in contact for a while, even after Percy became the Duke of Northumberland, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. So once Bill was back in England, Percy, and again, I think this shows the sort of man that Percy was, a great humanitarian and a man with a lot of compassion. He ensured that Bill was educated, firstly, so there's receipts in the castle, which show that Percy paid for him to be educated for several months by a local schoolmaster in 1778. I think that education lasted from July until December, ensuring that Bill could read and write, which, you know, gave him a massive leg up in British society. You know, for a free black slave to be taught how to read and write was quite unusual. You know, many white members of the working class at that time couldn't read and write, so that gives Bill a massive leg up and opportunity. And Percy also arranged for him to have an apprenticeship as a cabinet maker in York. So that apprenticeship would have lasted for 7 years, and at the end of that, Bill had a trade as well. He subsequently moved down to London and began working basically as a cabinet maker. So he's been given a fantastic opportunity by Percy to sort of advance within society. But also Bill himself has made the most of that opportunity through his intellect. He's always spoken of as a very clever man, and he's made the most of that opportunity and ended up in London making cabinets.
So he was in London making cabinets. What then prompted him to go into boxing?
Yeah, again, it's a little bit mysterious because he doesn't enter the professional boxing scene until he's in his 40s, which is a very late age to be becoming a boxer. At some point, Bill becomes mixed up with a guy known as Lord Camelford, who he works for, possibly as a bodyguard, possibly as a trainer, a personal trainer of some sort. Now, Camelford's quite a sort of outrageous figure who's always getting into various scrapes. At one point, I think he goes over to France to try and assassinate Napoleon. He's always getting into arguments with people, and he's actually killed eventually in a duel, which I think Bill was probably present at. But one thing that Camelford also had was that he was connected with the boxing scene. So that's probably how Bill was first introduced to it. Camelford would often attend prize fights. So I think Bill attended those fights with Camelford. And I think Bill was probably intoxicated by the glamour surrounding boxing, by the fact that there were these protagonists who were achieving, you know, fame and potential riches within the sport. So through Camelford, I think Bill sees, and Bill's always someone who's, you know, got an eye for social advancement and financial advancement. He sees an opportunity for a profession where he can make some more money. He sees an opportunity as well to maybe enter a profession that might be a bit more glamorous and exciting than cabinet making.
Certainly a very different profession to cabinet making. But he did excel at boxing. He was famous enough that he was one of the superstars. So what was special about him as a boxer that allowed him to get that celebrity status?
His athleticism and the fact that he was one of the first boxers to introduce certain techniques into the sport, that he would fight much more on what was known as the retreat, milling on the retreat. He was a counter-puncher, he was a slick mover. So, I mean, the majority of boxers at that time sort of stand up, moved forward, not much art or skill to what they were doing, not much athleticism or agility to what they were doing. Bill was very agile. He was smaller than most boxers at the time. There were no weight divisions at that time, so he's having to fight people 2, 3, or 4 stone heavier than him. So he works on trying to tire out his opponents by moving around the ring and so on. So a bit like a sort of precursor to somebody like Muhammad Ali in terms of his sort of defensive prowess and the skill and the science of boxing that he introduced, rather than just sort of standing and slugging it out without any skill or art whatsoever. So that's really what he was renowned for, the sweet science of self-defense, as we might term it.
Interesting that you mentioned Muhammad Ali, because we have two portraits of boxes in the Castle collection. One is a portrait of Bill Richmond. Mm-hmm. The other one is a signed photo of Muhammad Ali from when he visited the castle in the 1950s. So a nice little connection through boxing history.
Yeah, absolutely.
So he became a boxer. He got to the coronation of George IV. He's got that celebrity status. What happened towards the end of his life? How long did he box for?
Yeah, he was still boxing. I mean, his last significant contest that he actually fought and won was in his 50s, and he only ever lost two professional fights in his entire career. I think his final record, I discovered recently, a fight of his that hadn't been documented, so I think it ends up at being 18 wins and 2 defeats in his career. Yeah, an amazing record. Being unbeaten is very, very rare. There were probably more fights that we don't know about that maybe haven't been documented. But yeah, he was still, he beat a top contender in his 50s, and he continued training other fighters well into his advancing years and advising them. If ever any black fighters arrived in the UK from America, he would often, you know, mentor and train them. Most famously, there was a boxer called Tom Molyneux, who very nearly won the Championship of England and would have been the first ever black boxing champion. Bill trained him for 2 huge fights against a guy called Tom Cribb, who was the champion at the time, who Bill had a bit of a rivalry with early on in his career. Bill had been defeated by Cribb. Cribb then went on to become champion, and Bill saw, I think, in Tom Molyneux, his fellow black American, the opportunity to win the heavyweight championship, to win the championship of Britain, and they very nearly achieved it. The first Cribb-Molyneux fight, Molyneux was probably cheated. Again, there's conflicting accounts of exactly what happened, but there was some skullduggery at work that aided Cribb. They then had a huge rematch at a place called Thistleton Gap, which attracted about 10 or 15,000 people and was probably the biggest boxing match of the century. Unfortunately, Molyneux hadn't really trained as diligently as he could and had been a bit seduced by the celebrity lifestyle and lost that fight. And then soon afterwards, he and Bill sort of fell out, which was a real shame. But yeah, Bill continued training fighters late in his career, late into his life. I mean, the only sort of sour note in what was such a remarkable life really is that in his last couple of years, Bill did fall on hard times. And that's largely because the sport of boxing itself entered a bit of a slump. There weren't so many engaging characters around the sport. There was a lot of fight fixing going on and, you know, disreputable activity. So the sport itself was fading a bit from public consciousness. Bill's main income was coming from training fighters and giving boxing classes. So his trade fell off a little bit. He tried to run a butcher shop business, which failed. So when he actually died, sadly, his family were in quite a destitute situation after his death, which was very sad. The night that he dined with Tom Cribb at Tom Cribb's pub, which is actually still standing just off Leicester Square. It's called the Tom Cribb Pub, and there's a plaque to Bill Richmond outside from the BBC TV series Black and British: A Forgotten History. So Bill is now remembered on the site of that pub where he spent his last evening alongside Tom Cribb, his sort of rival-turned-friend.
Can you tell us a little bit more about his family? Did he have children and was he married?
Yeah, so Bill was married to a white English woman called Mary, and by all accounts, it seems to have been a very happy marriage. They were married, I think, in the 1790s, all the way through until his death. He had several children, one of whom, who was known as Young Richmond, tried to follow Bill into boxing as a career, not sadly with the success that Bill enjoyed. So yeah, he had several children. Unfortunately, you know, in the course of my research, somewhere around the sort of 1840s, 1850s, traces of his family seem to sort of disappear in public records. I don't know whether some of them maybe moved abroad or something like that, but there's a lot of sort of loose ends there. So one of my missions when I wrote this book was to try and find a modern day descendant of Bill Richmond, and unfortunately I've not yet succeeded in doing that, but there must be some out there because he did have several children. So there's probably somebody or various people out there who were related to Bill but don't even realise it. So hopefully one day we'll find a real life descendant of him.
So in terms of Bill Richmond, how important do you think he is, first in sporting history, but also in black British history?
Yeah, I think he's one of the key figures in both those contexts, to be honest with you. He was a pioneer. He got there first before anybody else did. He showed incredible bravery, incredible determination, and incredible fortitude. And really, you know, it's a story that shows us how far determination can take you, even in the most terrible and difficult of circumstances. And it's really been my mission through writing the book to have more people find out about him. And even now, you know, the book was published 7 or 8 years ago, I get emails from people who've read the book saying, you know, I've never heard of Bill before, what a remarkable character he was. You know, thank you for bringing him to attention. So I'm hoping now that he's finally got that place within British sporting and black history that he really deserves.
The book Richmond Unchained is excellent, but if people want to find out more, where are some other places where they might get a little bit extra information? The site of the Tom Cribb pub, for example, if people want to visit that plaque. And for you, is there anything you've got coming up?
Yeah, so if you're ever in London, the Tom Cribb pub is a great place to visit. There's actually two plaques to build. There's one portrait inside, which was unveiled at my book launch back in 2015. And it was actually unveiled by a member of the Percy family, George Percy. So then the portrait inside of Bill, which I think is the same Dighton print that you've got in your archives and up at Alnwick. And then there's the plaque on the outside of the pub from the BBC David Olushoga series, Black and British, A Forgotten History. So that's a sort of must-visit location if you're interested in Bill and in, you know, the history of boxing and the history of Black British culture as well. In terms of myself, my next book is actually nothing to do with boxing or that sort of thing. That I also have an interest in snooker, so my next book is a biography of a snooker hustler. And so I guess one of the things I do in my writing is I often try and uncover people from sporting history or sporting subculture who've maybe been overlooked or not been written about before, and that's another example of that. But one day I'd love to return to Bill's world. There's quite a bit of information I've found since I wrote the book. So when possible, I'd love to do a sort of further edition or an expanded edition or an updated edition. When that would be, I don't really know. And also, I'd urge people to visit Alnwick Castle itself, because that's somewhere that obviously, you know, Bill has a great connection with. It's also a beautiful part of the world. I gave a talk on the book there several years ago, and it was fascinating for me to visit and meet all the lovely people up there. And that's obviously a place that Bill would have known well. And just one more thing to add about the connection with Percy is we don't really know, after Bill ended up in London, how regularly the two of them were in contact. But there are newspaper reports from Percy's funeral, which I think was in July 1817, that make it clear that Bill was at Percy's funeral when he died. So clearly, even if they hadn't stayed in contact, he still had a great deal of respect, admiration and love for the man who transformed his life.
That seems like a happy note to end things on, really, with that lasting connection between the Lord of the Castle and this amazing boxer.
Fantastic. Well, look, thank you so much for the opportunity today to speak about Bill. It was great to talk to you.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Cheers. Thank you.
Thank you. Bill Richmond's life is fascinating, and we hope you enjoyed our conversation with Luke about him.
Richmond Unchained is available to buy now on ebook and in paperback. And if you visit the Lions of the North exhibition at Alnwick Castle, you'll see the famous Striking View portrait of Bill, which also features on the cover of Luke's book.
If you enjoyed this episode of the podcast, please let us know with a positive rating or review, or let your friends know with a share or recommendation.
We'll be back in 2 weeks with the next episode of the Alnwick Castle podcast. But until then, I've been Daniel.
And I've been Deborah.
Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.
Goodbye.